This is disc number 3.
Nikki paused, waiting for a lull in the flashes. When it came, when the room plunged back into darkness, she cast out not power, but its antecedent. That casting bathed the beast in the agonizingly almost, the inductive ignition of power, absent the consequence. She could see that the creature felt the strange sensation of the promise of the profound, not quite conjured, not yet delivered. It blinked in confusion, unsure if it really felt something, wanting to act, yet not knowing what it was that it felt or what to act against. Without the successful launch of any direct attack of Nikki's power, the beast appeared to decide that she had failed, and again defiantly lifted the candelabra high over its head, like a trophy won in battle. "Now!" Zed called to Anne and Nathan, as he rushed forward, "while it's distracted." They were about to ruin everything. Nikki could do nothing to halt their interference. Kara, never one to be gentle in her duty, did do something. She drove the three of them back like a sheepdog herding strays. They protested as they retreated, demanding she get out of the way. Nikki watched it all happening from a distant place on the cusp between worlds. She could no longer help Kara. The woman would have to handle it herself. Somewhere in the faraway world of life, Zed fumed at the moored Sith and tried to launch an attack, but Kara used the threat of ramming him with a shoulder to drive him back, throwing him not only off balance, but distracting him from his intentions. In that other world, the dark world beyond life, what Nikki had deliberately created was a void of effect, cause without consequence, a constructed expectation of a material release of her darker power, which she also deliberately failed to provide. Time itself seemed to stand still, waiting for what must be, but would not come. The tension in the air around Nikki was palpable. The green lines around her raced ever faster through the air in an effort to completely re-establish the verification web, to have her life held suspended. The flaw, like a spider in its web, waited for her. She knew she had only a fleeting moment before she would be unable to do anything. This time, her end would at least gain something of value. Nikki fed the field around the beast yet more of the open gateway to a profound release of power which she purposely withheld. The stress between what existed and what did not yet exist and would not happen was insufferable. In an instant, that terrible, intolerable void, that vacuum of power that Nikki had created in both worlds, was filled with the deafening release of a bolt of lightning that came crashing in through the window, while its twin, from the world beyond the world of life, ripped through the veil, drawn to the need unfulfilled around the beast, compelled to complete what Nikki had begun but would not finish. This time, there was no safety in escape to another world. Both worlds had together unleashed their fury. Shattered glass rained through the room. The thunderous boom shook the stone walls of the keep. It seemed as if the sun itself were exploding in through the window. The lines racing around Nikki came up like a shroud. Through her gifted vision, she saw the completion of the link she had established, saw the lightning find the void around the beast and fulfill the terrible, empty obligation she had created. The explosion of that lightning was beyond anything that she had ever seen before. Creating the precursor in both worlds lent the lightning the power of both worlds, additive and subtractive, creative and destructive, intertwined in a single calamitous discharge. Nikki was frozen by the spell and could not close her eyes against the blinding flash of light and dark that tangled together, striking both ends of the candelabra and blasting down through the beast. In the violent corona of crackling white light, the beast came apart, driven to dust and vapor by the intensity of the heat and power focused in the void Nikki had created. Gales of rain and wind roared in through the shattered window. Outside, yet more lightning flickered through the roiling greenish clouds. When the lightning outside lit the room, they could all see that the beast was gone. For now, anyway, it was gone. Through the net of green lines, Nikki saw Richard racing across the room toward her. That room seemed so distant. She saw the dark world close in around her. Chapter 8. When her horse whinnied and stamped its hooves, Kaylin slipped her hand farther up the reins, closer to the bit, to hold the nervous animal in place. The horse didn't like what it smelled any more than Kaylin did. She reached up and gently stroked the underside of the horse's chin as she waited behind sisters Ulysia and Cecilia. Light gusts ruffled the cottonwood leaves overhead, making the glossy leaves shimmer in the midday light. In the shade of those huge cottonwoods, dappled sunlight danced over the grassy hilltop, while overhead a few cottony white clouds dotted the blindingly bright blue sky. When the breeze shifted around and came in from their backs, it brought relief not only from the sweltering heat. Kaylin allowed herself a deeper breath. She used a finger to wipe sweat and grime from under the metal collar locked around her neck. She wished she could have a bath, or at least jump in a stream or a lake. The summer heat and dusty traveling had conspired to turn her long hair into an itchy, tangled mess. She knew, though, that the sisters didn't care how uncomfortable she was, and that they wouldn't be pleased if she were to ask if she could have a chance to wash up, the way they often did. The sisters didn't care in the least about Kaylin's wants, much less her comfort. She was their slave, no more. It mattered not if the collar she wore around her neck chafed and rubbed her skin raw. As Kaylin waited, her mind wandered to the statue she had given up, the statue she'd had to leave in Lord Richard Rawl's palace. While she had no memory of her past, she had memorized every line of that figure of a woman with flowing hair and robes. There was something quietly noble about her spirit, about the way the figure stood with her back arched, her hands fisted, and her head thrown back as if in defiance of invisible forces that would subdue her. Kayla knew all too well what it felt like to have invisible forces subduing her. From the quiet hilltop they watched as Sister Armina made her way across the open landscape below. There was no one else in sight. The long grasses looked almost liquid as they waved and bowed in the breeze. Sister Armina finally trotted her bay mare up the hill. She circled her horse around and came to a halt beside the rest of them. "They're not there," she announced. "How far ahead are they?" Sister Ulysia asked. Sister Armina lifted an arm to point. "I didn't go much beyond those hills there. I didn't want to take a chance on being spotted by any of Jagang's gifted. As near as I can tell, though, the stragglers and camp followers have only moved on a day or two ago." When the breeze at their backs slackened, it allowed the smell to drift up the hill again. Kaylin wrinkled her nose. Sister Ulysia noticed, but didn't comment. The sisters didn't seem to be at all bothered by the stench. Sister Ulysia abruptly turned and stuffed a boot in a stirrup. "Let's go have a look over the hills beyond," she said as she swung up into her saddle. Kaylin mounted up and followed after the other three women as they trotted their horses down the hill. She thought it odd that the sisters seemed unusually jumpy. They tended to be arrogantly bold in whatever they did, but now they were being cautious. To the left towered the rugged, blue-gray shapes of lofty mountains. The rock slopes and cliffs were so imposing that there were few places where trees could gain a foothold. Some of the peaks were so high that they had snow atop them, despite it being summer. Kaylin and the sisters had followed those mountains south since finding a place to cross over them after leaving the people's palace. In those travels, the sisters had avoided going near people whenever they could. Kaylin gave her horse's reins a little more slack. The hills they rode across were rutted with gullies that made it difficult traveling at times. Kaylin knew that there would probably be roads down out of the hills, but the sisters didn't generally like to travel on roads and kept off them whenever possible. As they moved through the tall grass among the scattered trees, they stayed in the concealing shelter of the folds of land between hills. Before Kaylin could see any of what lay ahead, the unmistakable, gagging stench of death grew so terrible that she could hardly breathe. Cresting a hill, She finally saw the city spread out below. They all paused, gazing down at the empty roads, the burned buildings, and the carcasses of what looked to be horses. "Let's be quick," Sister Alicia said. "We'll take the main road on the other side for a ways and get close enough to be sure of where they are and exactly the direction they're headed." They spurred their horses into canters as they rode in silence down out of the hills and into the fringes of the city. The place looked to have been built up around a meandering bend in a river, and the crossings of several roads that were probably trade routes. The larger of two timber bridges had been burned. As they crossed a narrow second bridge in single file, Kaelin glanced down at the water. Bloated bodies floating face down had collected in the reeds. Even before seeing them, the stench of death had been so heavy in the air that she had lost her interest in going for a swim. She just wanted to be away from the place. As they rode in among the buildings, Kaelin held a scarf over her nose and mouth. It didn't help much. She thought she might vomit from the fetid smell of rotting flesh. It seemed peculiar that it was so strong. She soon discovered why. They rode past side streets where corpses were piled in the hundreds. A few dogs and mules lay dead among them, the legs of the mules standing out straight and stiff. From the way the bodies were jammed into the narrow side streets, Kaelin thought that the people must have been herded into confined spaces from which escape was impossible, and then slaughtered. Most of the dead, animal and human, were ripped open with ghastly wounds. Some of the dead had broken lances jutting from them, while others had been killed by arrows. Most, though, appeared to have been hacked to death. Kaelin noticed one other thing about them. They were all older people. Many of the buildings in one section of the city were burned down. Only in a few places did wisps of smoke still curl up from some of the thicker piles of rubble. The charred wooden beams looked like the scorched skeletons of monsters. It appeared to be a day or two since the fires had burned themselves out. Stepping their horses along the narrow, cobbled street between two-story buildings looming up to either side of the road, they peered about in silent appraisal of the destruction. The buildings still standing had all been looted. Doors were broken in or lay in the street nearby. Kaelin didn't see a single window that hadn't been broken. Curtains lay draped over a few of the tiny balconies overlooking the street. A few of those balconies held a body. Besides the fragments of wood from door frames and the broken glass, the streets were littered with trivial items, random articles of clothing, a bloody boot, pieces of broken furniture, broken weapons, broken pieces of wagons. Kaelin saw a doll with yellow yarn for hair lying face down, its back flattened by a hoof print. All of the items had the look of having been picked over by a number of hands, and after being judged to be worthless, discarded. Daring to look into the dark buildings they passed, Kaelin saw the real horrors. They were not merely the bodies of murdered townspeople. They were the bodies of people who looked to have been murdered for sport, or out of a sheer brutality. Unlike the bodies heaped in the side streets, these people were not older. They looked like they might have been people trying to protect their shops or homes. Through one broken shop window, she saw that a man, wearing the kind of apron used by cobblers, had been nailed to a wall by his wrists. From the center of his chest protruded dozens of arrows, making him look like a grotesque pincushion. His mouth and each eye had been penetrated by an arrow. The man had not only been used for target practice, but as an object of monstrous humor. In other dark buildings, Kaelin saw women who had all too obviously been raped. A shirt sleeve still on one arm was all that covered one woman on a floor. Her breasts had been mutilated. In another place, a girl, looking not yet to have grown into womanhood, lay sprawled on a table, her dress pushed up past her waist. Her throat had been cut through to her spine. Her legs lay splayed out, a broomstick left shoved in her as a final act of disdain. Kaelin felt numb as she saw one horrifying sight after another, each of such lurid cruelty that she could not imagine the kind of men who could have committed such acts. By the manner of dress of many of the dead, the men appeared to be simple working people. They were not soldiers. For the crime of trying to protect their homes and businesses, they had been butchered. As Kaylin passed one small building, she saw in a back corner against a brick wall a pile of small children, mostly babies. It was reminiscent of the way autumn leaves collected in a corner, except these all had once been living people with a life ahead of them. The gore on the brick wall betrayed where their heads had been bashed in. It was apparent that the killers had wanted to dispatch them as efficiently as possible. On the silent ride through the city, Kaylin saw several more places where the very young had been cast into piles after being murdered in a fashion that could only be described as entertainment for the most monstrous of men. Although there were not very many women among the dead, Kaylin didn't see one who was fully clothed. The ones she did see were either older or pretty young. Their treatment had been bestial beyond imagining, and their deaths slow. Kaylin swallowed back the lump in her throat as she wiped her eyes. She wanted to scream. The three sisters didn't seem to be particularly moved by the carnage in the city. They watched down the side streets and gazed at the surrounding hills, apparently concerned about any sign of a threat. Kaylin had never been so happy to leave a place as she was when they finally made their way out of the city and took a road leading southeast. The road turned out not to be the escape from the outrages of the city that she thought it would be. Along the way, the ditches were here and there filled with the bodies of unarmed young men and older boys, probably executed for trying to escape, resisting the idea of slavery, as lessons to the others, or simply for the sport of murder. Kaylin felt dizzy and hot. She feared she might be sick. The way she swayed in her saddle only made her nausea worse. The stench of death and charred flesh followed them in the bright sunshine as they rode among the hills on the far side of the city. The smell was so pervasive that it felt as if it had saturated her clothes and was even coming out in her sweat. She doubted that she would ever again sleep without nightmares. Kaylin didn't know what the name of the city had been, but it was no more. There hadn't been a single person left alive. Anything of value had either been destroyed or looted. By the number of corpses, as vast as they had been, she knew that many of the city's inhabitants, mostly the women, the ones of the right age anyway, had been taken as slaves. After seeing what had happened to the women left dead in the city, Kaylin could vividly imagine what would happen to the women taken away. The broadening plain and the hills to either side, for as far as Kaylin could see, had been trampled by what had to be well beyond mere hundreds of thousands of men. The grasses had not simply been flattened by countless boots, hooves, and wagon wheels, but had been ground to dust under the weight of unthinkable numbers. The sight put into perspective the magnitude of the masses that had passed through the city, and in a way was more horrifying than the ghastly scenes of death. A force of men this huge bordered on a force of nature itself, like some terrible storm that cut a swath across the face of the land, mercilessly destroying everything in its path. Later in the day, as they approached the crest of a hill, the sisters carefully maneuvered into a position that put the sun low at their backs so that anyone ahead would have to stare into the sun to see them. Sister Alicia slowed and stood in her stirrups, stretching for a careful look, then signaled the rest of them to dismount. They all tied their horses to the carcass of a scraggly old pine split in two by lightning. Sister Alicia told Kaylin to stay close behind them. At the edge of the hill, as they crouched silently in the weedy grass, they finally caught their first glimpse of what had come through the fallen city. In the dim distance, spread across the hazy horizon, was what at first appeared to be a muddy brown sea, but was actually the dark taint of an army of such numbers that it was beyond counting. Carried on the wind, in the quiet late-day air, Kaylin could just make out the distant, blood-curdling sounds of howls, women's screams, and men's raucous laughter coming from the massive mob. The sheer weight of such multitudes would have crushed the defenses of any city. Any armed opposition would hardly have been noticed by an army as vast as this one. Men gathered in such numbers could not be halted by anything. But as much as this army seemed to be a mass, a mob, a thing, she knew that it was wrong to think of it in those terms. This was a group of individuals. These men had not been born monsters. Each had once been a helpless babe cradled in a mother's arms. Each had once been a child with fears, hopes, and dreams. While an occasional aberrant individual could, because of a sick mind, grow up to be a remorseless killer, this many individuals had not. Each was a killer by conviction to a cause, a killer by choice, all united under a banner of perverse beliefs that gave sanction to their savagery. These were all individuals who, when confronted with the choice, had willfully cast away the inherent nobility of life and chose instead to be the servants of death. Kaelin had been horrified at the butcheries she'd seen back in the city, nauseated by the things she had seen. For a time she'd hardly been able to breathe, not just from the stench of death, but from her tearful despair at such mindless brutality, at such monumental and intentional depravity. She felt a sense of sickening dread for those helpless souls yet to face the Horde, and a crushing loss of any hope that life could ever be worth living, that it could ever be reasoned and secure, much less joyous. But now, at the sight of the source of the slaughter, the great force of men who had all willingly perpetrated such atrocities, all those desolate feelings melted away. In their place, smoldering anger ignited, the kind of inner rage she didn't think a person very often felt in their life. Remembering the old people who had been hacked apart, the infants dispatched by bashing in their brains, and the savage treatment of the women, Kaelin could think of little else but her burning desire for vengeance for the silent dead. That sense of rage seethed through her, a rage so terrible that it seemed to forever change something within her. In that moment, she felt a profound affinity with the small statue she'd had to leave in Richard Rawl's peaceful garden, an understanding of its spirit that she hadn't had before. "It's Jagang, all right," Sister Cecilia finally said in a bitter voice. Sister Armina nodded. "And we have to get past him if we're to get to Casca." Sister Ulysia gestured to the wall of mountains to the left. "Their army, with all their horses, wagons, and supplies, can't cross the narrow passes between those peaks, but we can. As slow as Jagang moves, we can easily get over the passes and then to Casca long before they can travel south to get past the mountains and then move up into Dahara." Sister Cecilia stared off to the horizon. "The Daharan army doesn't stand a chance against that." "That's not our problem," Sister Ulysia said. "But what about our bond to Richard Rawl?" Sister Armina asked. "We're not the ones attacking Richard Rawl," Sister Ulysia said. "Jagang is the one going after him, seeking to destroy him, not us. We are the ones who will wield the power of Warden, and then we will grant Richard Rawl what only we will have the power to grant. That is enough to preserve our bond and protect us from the Dreamwalker. Jagang and his army are not our problem, and what they aim to do is not our responsibility." Kaelin remembered being at the People's Palace and wondering what the man was like. Even though she didn't know him, she feared for him and his people having to face what was coming for them. "It will be our problem if they get to Casca before us," Sister Cecilia said. "Besides catching up with Tovey, Casca is the only other central site we can get into for now." Sister Ulysia dismissed the notion with a flick of her hand. "They're a long way from Casca. We can easily cut the distance and outpace them by going over the mountains rather than down, around, and then back up, as they will have to do." "You don't think they might quicken their pace?" Sister Armina asked. "After all, Jagang might be eager to finish off Lord Rawl and the Daharan forces." Sister Ulysia huffed at the very idea. "Jagang knows the Daharan army has nowhere else to go. Richard Rawl has no choice now but to stand and fight. The matter is as good as decided. It's only a matter of time. The Dreamwalker is in no hurry, nor could he be. Not with an army that huge and unwieldy. And even if they could quicken their pace, they have to travel a much greater distance, so that still wouldn't get him to Kaska before we can get there. Besides, Jagang's army is the same now as it has been since they first took over the old world, decades ago, and as it has been throughout this entire war. They never hurry their pace. They are like the seasons. They move with great force, but very slowly. She cast a meaningful look at the other two sisters. Besides, they've just stripped the city of women. Jagang's men will be eager to enjoy their new spoils. The blood drained from Sister Armina's face. Don't we know the truth of that? Jagang and his men never tire of the use of captive women, Sister Cecilia said, half to herself. Sister Armina's color came back in a red rush. I'd love to string Jagang up and have my way with him. We'd all enjoy a bit of dealing out lessons to those men, Sister Alicia said as she stared off into the distance. But we have better things to do. She smirked. Someday, though. The three sisters were silent for a time as they gazed off at the vast horde spread across the horizon. Someday, Sister Cecilia said in a low, rancorous voice, we will open the boxes of Orden, and we will have the power to make that man twist in the wind. Sister Alicia turned and headed back toward the horses. If we are ever going to open one of the three boxes, then we will first have to get to Tovi and the last box. And to what else is in Kaska? Forget about Jagang and his army. This is the last we'll have to see them. Until the day comes when we've unleashed the power of Orden, and we can have a bit of fun dealing out our own personal retribution to the Dreamwalker. Chapter 9. Nikki opened her eyes. She saw only vague shapes. Zed is angry with you. Even though it sounded as if it had come from some hazy, faraway place, she knew that it was Richard's voice. She was surprised to hear it. She was surprised to hear anything. She thought that by all rights she should be dead. As her vision started coming into focus, Nikki rolled her head to the right and saw him sitting huddled close on a chair that had been pulled right up beside the bed, leaning forward, elbows on his knees, his fingers folded neatly together. He was watching her. Why? She asked. Looking relieved to see her awake, he leaned back in the simple wooden chair and smiled that crooked smile of his that she so loved seeing. Because you broke the window back in that room where you were all doing the verification web. In the light of a lamp glowing softly beneath a milky white shade, she saw that she was covered up to her armpits in a luxuriously embroidered gold bed cover with lustrous sage-green fringe. She had on a satiny nightdress that she didn't recognize. The sleeves went all the way down to her wrists. It was pale pink, not her color. She wondered where the nightdress had come from, and, more to the point, who had undressed her and put it on her. Back at the Palace of the Prophets, so long ago, Richard had been the first person she'd ever met who didn't expect that he had a right to her body, or some other aspect of her life. That forthright attitude had helped start the process of reasoning that eventually led to her casting off a lifetime of teachings of the Order. Through Richard, she had come to truly see that her life belonged to her alone. Along with that comprehension, she had since then discovered the dignity and self-worth in propriety. Right then, though, she had concerns other than finding herself in a pink nightdress. Her throbbing head felt impossibly heavy against the cozy pillow. Technically, she said, the lightning broke the window, not me. Somehow, Kara said from another chair tipped back against the wall beside the door, I don't think the distinction will much impress him. I suppose not, Nikki said with a sigh. That room is in the hardened section of the keep. Richard twitched a frown. It's where? She squinted slightly in an effort to bring his face more into focus. That section of the keep is a special place. It's hardened against intentional interference as well as aberrational and errant events. Kara folded her arms. Mind giving us the translation? The woman was in her red leather. Nikki wondered if that meant there was more trouble about, or if she was just surly from the beast paying them a visit. It's a containment field, Nikki said. We know very little about the ancient, bewilderingly intricate makeup of the Chainfire spell. It's hazardous to even study such unstable components all tangled together the way that one is. That's why we were using that particular place to run the verification web. That room is in the original core of the keep, an important sanctuary used for tasks involving anomalous material. Various kinds of both constructed and free-formed conjuring are apt to contain innate tangential outflows that can convey domain breaches. So when working with them, it's best to confine such potentially hazardous components to a containment field. Oh, well, thanks for the translation, Kara said in a cutting tone. It's all so clear now. It's a field thing. Nikki nodded as best she could. Yes, a containment field. When Kara's frown only darkened, Nikki added, Doing magic in there is like keeping a wasp in a bottle. Oh, Kara let out a sigh, finally grasping the simplified concept. I guess that explains why Zed was so grumpy about it. Maybe he can fix it back the way it was, Richard offered. Surprisingly enough, the room isn't too badly torn up. It's mostly the broken windows that he's riled about. Nikki lifted a hand in a weak gesture. I don't doubt it. The glass in there is unique. It has embedded properties designed to contain conjured magic from escaping, and to prevent gifted assaults. Its function is much the same as shields, except that it deters power rather than people. Richard considered a moment. Well, he finally said, it didn't prevent an attack from the beast. Nikki stared off at the bookshelves built into the wall opposite the bed. Nothing can, she said. In this case, the beast didn't come through the windows or walls. It came through the veil, emerging out of the underworld right into the room. It didn't need to come through any shields or containment field or refractory glass. Kara's chair thumped down, and it nearly tore your arm off. She shook a finger at Richard. You were using your gift. You drew it to you. If Zed hadn't been there to heal you, you would likely have bled to death. Oh, Kara, every time you tell the story, I seem to bleed more. No doubt the next time I hear it told, I'll have been torn in two and stitched back together again with magic thread. She folded her arms as she tipped her chair back against the wall. You could have been torn in two. I wasn't as badly hurt as you make out. I'm fine. Richard leaned in a little and squeezed Nikki's hand. At least you stopped it. She met his gaze. For now, she said, that's all. For now is enough for now. He smiled in quiet satisfaction. You did good, Nikki. His gray eyes mirrored his inner sincerity. Somehow the world always seemed better when Richard was pleased that someone had accomplished something difficult. He always seemed to value what people achieved, always seemed to delight in their triumphs. It invariably lifted her heart when he was pleased with something she had done. Her gaze strayed from his face. She noticed the small statue standing on the table just behind him. The lamplight highlighted the flowing hair and robes that Richard had once so carefully carved into the figure of his impression of Kaelin's spirit. The lustrous statue, sculpted from walnut, stood as if in silent defiance of some invisible force attempting to suppress that spirit. I'm in your room, Nikki said, half to herself. A curious frown twitched across his brow. How did you know? Nikki looked away from the statue to gaze out the small, round-topped window through the thick stone wall to the left. A delicate pale blush of color was just visible in the lower reaches of a black, star-filled sky as dawn gradually approached. Lucky guess, she lied. It was closer, Richard explained. Zed and Nathan wanted to get you in a bed, get you comfortable, so they could evaluate what they needed to do to help you. Nikki knew by the lingering, icy feeling coursing through her veins that they had done something more than mere evaluation. Rika and I undressed you and put you in a nightdress Zed found for us, Kara explained to the unspoken question she must have seen in Nikki's eyes. Thanks. Nikki lifted a hand in a vague gesture. How long have I been unconscious? What happened? Well, Richard said, after you jumped back up into that spell form the night before last and called the lightning to stop the beast, the verification web nearly took you for good. After I got you out, Zed thought you needed to rest more than anything, so he did a little something so that you would sleep. You were a bit delirious from the pain you were in. He said that he helped you drift off so you wouldn't have to suffer it. He told us that you would sleep all of yesterday and last night, and then awake around dawn today. I guess he had it right. Kara rose to stand behind Richard and peer down at Nicky. No one thought that Lord Rawl would be able to get you out the second time. They thought your spirit was too far gone into the underworld to ever get you back. But he did it. He got you back. Nicky looked from Kara's smug smile to Richard's gray eyes. They didn't reflect anything of the difficulty of the task. She had trouble imagining how he could have accomplished such a thing. "You did good, Richard," she said, making him smile. He and Kara turned toward a soft knock at the door. Zed quietly eased the door open to peek in. When he saw that Nicky was awake, he shed his care and strolled in. "Ah," he observed. "Back from the dead, it would appear." Nicky smiled. "Wretched excursion. I don't advise a visit to the place. Sorry about the windows, but it was either better the windows than what might have happened to Richard." Nicky was cheered to hear him say as much. "That was my thought. Sometime you will have to explain to me exactly what you did and how you did it. I wasn't aware that any form of conjured power could breach those windows." "It can't. I simply invited a confluence of natural power to come in through the windows." Zed regarded her with an unreadable look. "About the windows," he finally said in a measured tone, "we might be able to use your ability with both sides of the gift to restore them." "I'd be glad to help." Kara took a step forward. "When Tom and Friedrich eventually get back from patrolling the surrounding countryside, I'm sure that they'd be able to help with the windows woodwork. Friedrich, especially, knows about working with wood." Zed nodded as he smiled briefly at the suggestion before turning to his grandson. "Where have you been? I went looking for you this morning and couldn't find you. I've been looking for you all day." Nicky realized that the windows were hardly his primary concern. Richard glanced briefly at the statue. "I read a lot last night. When it got light, I went for a walk to think about what to do next." Zed sighed at the answer. "Well, as I told you after you broke the first spell form holding Nicky, we need to talk about some of the things you said." It was clear that it was not a matter of casual curiosity, but a pointed demand. Richard stood to help stuff pillows behind Nicky when he saw her start to sit up. The pain was becoming no more than a fading memory. Zed had obviously done something more than help her sleep. Her head was starting to clear. She realized that she was hungry. "So talk," Richard said as he sat back down. "I need you to explain precisely how you are able to know how to shut down a verification web, especially one as complex as the Chainfire Event Matrix." Richard looked more than a little weary. "I told you before, I understand the jargon of emblems." Zed clasped his hands behind his back as he started to pace. Concern was clearly etched in the lines of his face. "Yes, about that. You mentioned that you know a lot about representational designs involving lethality. I need to know what you meant by that." Richard took a deep breath, letting it out slowly as he leaned back in his chair. Having grown up around Zed, he obviously knew quite well that when Zed wanted to know something, it was easiest to just answer the questions. Richard turned his wrists over across his knees. Strange symbols girded the leather-padded silver wristbands he wore. On the center of each band, at the insides of his wrists, there was a small grace. That alone was alarming enough, since Nicky had seen Richard use them to call the Sliff so that they could travel. She couldn't begin to imagine what the other symbols meant. These things all around the bands, the emblems, designs, and devices, are pictures representing things. Like I said before, they're a jargon, a language of sorts. Zed waggled a finger at the designs on the wristbands. "And you can make out meaning in them? Like you did with the spell form?" "Yes. Most are ways of fighting with the sword. That's how I was first able to recognize them and how I began to learn to understand them." Richard's fingers idly sought reassurance in the touch of the weapon's hilt, but it was no longer there at his hip. He caught himself and went on. "Many of these are the same as the designs outside the first wizard's enclave. You know, on those brass plaques, on the entablature, above the variegated redstone columns, on the round metal discs all along the frieze, and also carved into the stone of the cornice. He glanced over his shoulder at his grandfather. Most of these emblems overtly involve combat with a sword. Nikki blinked in surprise as she listened. Richard had never told her about the symbols on the wristbands. As first wizard, Zed had been the keeper of the Sword of Truth, and it was his duty to name a new seeker when needed. But given his reaction, she didn't think that even he had known about this. She supposed that was understandable. The sword, after all, had been made thousands of years before by wizards with prodigious power. That one. Zed thrust a bony finger at an emblem on one of Richard's wristbands. That one is on the door to the first wizard's enclave. Richard turned his other wrist and tapped a starburst pattern on the top of the silver band. As is this one here. Zed pulled Richard's arms closer, inspecting the wristbands in the lamplight. Yes, those are both on the door. He squinted a frown at Richard. And you honestly believe that they mean something? And that you've learned to read them? Yes, of course. Zed, his wiry brows drawing low, was still clearly dubious. What do you think they mean? Richard touched a symbol on the wristbands, and one like it on his boot pins. He pointed out the same design within the gold band around his black tunic. Until he pointed it out, Nikki hadn't realized that it was hidden there, among the rest of what seemed to be nothing more than an elaborate decorative strip. The pattern looked like two rough triangles with a sinuous, undulating double line running around and through them. This one is a kind of rhythm used for fighting when outnumbered. It conveys a sense of the cadence of the dance, movements without iron form. Zed cocked an eyebrow. Movement without iron form? Yes, you know, movement that's not rigid, not prescribed and inflexible, yet is still deliberate, with specific intent as well as precise objectives. This emblem describes an integral part of the dance. The dance? Richard nodded. The dance with death. Zed's jaw worked a moment before his voice returned. Dance with death. He stammered a moment more with the halting beginnings of a flurry of questions, before finally pausing and then retreating to something simpler. And how does this connect with the symbols of the first wizard's enclave? Richard burnished a thumb across the forms on the left wristband. The symbols would have meaning to a war wizard. That, in part, is how I figured it out. Symbols have significance in many professions. Tailors paint shears on their window. A weapons maker might paint the outline of knives over his door. A tavern might have a sign with a mug on it. A blacksmith an anvil. And a farrier might nail up horseshoes. Some signs, a skull with crossed bones beneath it, for instance, warn of something deadly. War wizards likewise put signs up on the first wizard's enclave. Even more importantly, each profession has its own jargon, a specialized vocabulary specific to that craft. It's no different with a war wizard. The jargon of his profession has to do with lethality. These symbols here and outside the first wizard's enclave are in part the sign of his craft, bringing death. Zed cleared his throat, then looked down and pointed at another symbol on Richard's wristband. This one, here. This one is on the door to my enclave. Do you know its meaning? Can you paraphrase its intent? Richard turned his wrist slightly as he glanced down at the starburst symbol. It's an admonition not to allow your vision to lock on any one thing. The starburst is a warning to look everywhere at once, to see nothing to the exclusion of everything else. It's a reminder that you mustn't allow the enemy to draw your attention in a way that directs your vision and makes it settle on one thing. If you do, you will see what he wishes you to see. Doing so will allow him to blind you, in a manner of speaking, and he will then come at you without you seeing him, and you will most likely lose your life. Instead, like this starburst, your vision must open to all there is, never settling, even when cutting. To dance with death means to understand and become as one with your enemy, meaning with the way he thinks within the range of his knowledge, so that you know his sword as well as your own, its exact location, its speed, and its next move before it comes, without having to wait to see it first. By opening your vision in this way, opening all your senses, you come to know your enemy's mind and moves as if by instinct. Zed scratched his temple. You're trying to tell me that these symbols, signs specific to war wizards, are all instructions for using a sword? Richard shook his head. The word sword is meant to represent all forms of struggle, not just combat or fighting with a weapon. It applies just as much to strategy and leadership, among other things in life. Dancing with death means being committed to the value of life, committed with your mind, heart, and soul, so that you are truly prepared to do what is necessary to preserve life. Dancing with death means that you are the incarnation of death, come to reap the living, in order to preserve life. Zed looked thunderstruck. Richard seemed somewhat surprised by Zed's reaction. All of this is much in keeping with everything you've ever taught me, Zed. The lamplight cast sharp shadows across Zed's angular face. I suppose that in a way it is, Richard. But at the same time, it's so much more. Richard nodded as he rubbed a thumb across the softly glowing silver surface of a wristband. He seemed to search for words. Zed, I know that you would have wanted to be the one to teach me about all the things having to do with your enclave. Like you wanted to be the one to teach me about the Grace. As first wizard, it was your place to do so. Perhaps I should have waited. He brought up a fist in conviction. But there were lives at stake and things I had to do. I had to learn it without you. Bags, Richard. How would I teach you about such things? He said in resignation. The meaning of those symbols has been lost for thousands of years. No wizard no wizard I know of has ever been able to decipher them. I have trouble imagining how you did. Richard shrugged one shoulder self-consciously. Once I began to catch on, it all became pretty obvious. Zed cast a troubled look at his grandson. Richard, I grew up in this place. I've spent a great deal of my life here. I was first wizard when there were actually wizards here to direct. He shook his head. All that time, those designs were on the first wizard's enclave, and I never knew what they meant. It may seem simple and obvious to you, but it is not. For all I know, you're just imagining that you understand the emblems, just making up meaning you want to be there. I'm not imagining their meaning. They've saved my life countless times. I learned a great deal about how to fight with a sword by understanding the language of these symbols. Zed didn't argue, but instead gestured at the amulet Richard wore around his neck. In the center, surrounded by a complex of gold and silver lines, was a teardrop-shaped ruby as big as Nikki's thumbnail. You found that in my enclave. Do you also have an idea of what it means? It was part of this outfit, part of the outfit worn by a war wizard. But unlike the rest of it, like you said, this was left in the protection of the first wizard's enclave. And its meaning? Richard's fingers reverently brushed the amulet. The ruby is meant to represent a drop of blood. The emblems engraved in this talisman are the symbolic representation of the way of the primary edict. Zed pressed his fingers to his forehead, as if confounded by yet another confusing conundrum. The primary edict? Richard's gaze seemed lost in the amulet. It means only one thing, and everything. Cut. Once committed to fight, cut. Everything else is secondary. Cut. That is your duty, your purpose, your hunger. There is no rule more important, no commitment that overrides that one. Cut. Richard's words came softly, with a kind of knowing, deadly seriousness that chilled Nikki to the bone. He lifted the amulet out away from his chest, his gaze fixed on its ornate engravings. The engraved lines are a portrayal of the dance, and as such they have a specific meaning. He traced a finger along the swirling designs as he spoke, as if following a line of text in an ancient language. Cut from the void, not from bewilderment. Cut the enemy as quickly and directly as possible. Cut with certainty. Cut decisively, resolutely. Cut into his strength. Flow through the gaps in his guard. Cut him. Cut him down utterly. Don't allow him a breath. Crush him. Cut him without mercy to the depths of his spirit. Richard glanced up at his grandfather. It is the balance to life, death. It is the dance with death, or, more precisely, the mechanism of the dance with death. Its essence reduced to form. Its form prescribed by concepts. It is the law a war wizard lives by, or he dies. Zed's hazel eyes were unreadable. So these marks, these emblems, ultimately regard a war wizard as a mere swordsman? The same overriding principle I told you about before applies to this just as it does to the other symbols. The primary edict is not meant to merely convey how a war wizard fights with a weapon, but more importantly, with his mind. It's a fundamental understanding of the nature of reality that must encompass everything he does. By being true to the primary edict, any weapon is an extension of his mind, an agent of his intent. In a way, it's what you once told me about being the seeker. It's not the weapon that matters so much as the man who wields the weapon. The man who last wore this amulet was once first wizard. His name was Barakas. He also happened to have been born a war wizard, as I am. He, too, went to the Temple of the Winds, but when he returned, he went into the First Wizard's Enclave, left this there, came out, and committed suicide by leaping off the side of the keep. Richard's gaze drifted into distant visions and memories. For a time, I understood and ached to join him. Nicky was relieved when the haunted look in his gray eyes was banished by the return of his easy smile. But I came to my senses. The room rang with the silence, as if death itself had just silently glided through the room, paused for a moment, and then moved on. Zed at last smiled himself as he gripped Richard's shoulder, giving his grandson an affectionate joggle. "I'm glad to know I made the right choice in naming you Seeker, my boy." Nicky wished that Richard still had the sword that belonged with the Seeker, but he had sacrificed it for information in an attempt to find Kaelin. "So," Zed said at last, getting back to the matter at hand, "because you know about these symbols, you believe you understood symbols within the Chainfire spell form." "I was able to shut it down, wasn't I?" Zed clasped his hands behind his back again. "You have a point there. But that doesn't necessarily mean that you could read forms within the spell as emblems, much less know that the spell form was corrupted by the chimes." "Not the chimes themselves," Richard patiently explained, "but the contamination left behind as a result of the chimes having been in this world. That corruption is what infected the Chainfire spell. That's the issue." Zed turned away, his face hidden in shadows. "But still, Richard, even if you actually do understand something of the emblems having to do with war wizards, how can you be sure that you accurately understand this... He gestured in the vague direction of the room where it had all happened. "This other business with the Chainfire spell and the chimes." "I know," Richard insisted in a quiet voice. "I saw the mark of the nature of the corruption. It was caused by the chimes." He sounded tired. Nicky wondered how long he'd been up. Because of the arid timbre to his voice and the slightest unsteadiness in his movements, she suspected that it had probably been days since he'd slept. Despite how weary he may have been, he sounded resolute in his conviction. She knew that it was his worry for Kaelin driving him on. Nicky, having been pulled out of the spell form by him twice, wasn't one to want to so easily discount his theory. More than that, though, she had come to understand that Richard had an insight into magic that was very different from the conventional wisdom. At first, she had thought that his perception of how magic functioned in part through artistic concepts was a product of his having been raised without having been taught about magic, without having any exposure to it. But she had since come to see that that unique insight, along with his singular intellect, had enabled him to grasp an essential nature of magic that was fundamentally different from the orthodox teachings. Nicky had come to believe that Richard might actually understand magic in a way not envisioned by anyone since ancient times. Zed turned back, his face illuminated by the warm glow of lamplight on one side and, on the other, the faint cold light of dawn. "Richard, let's say you're right about the meaning of the symbols on those wristbands and the ones like them on the First Wizard's Enclave. Understanding those things does not mean that you can understand the lines within a verification web. It's a completely different and unique context. I'm not doubting your ability, my boy, I'm really not. But dealing with spell forms is a vastly complex matter. You can't leap to the conclusion, have you seen a dragon in the last couple of years? Everyone in the room fell to stunned silence at Richard's sudden change of topic. And not just to any subject, but one that could only be described as strange at best. A dragon? Zed ventured at last, like a man inching out onto a newly frozen lake. Yes, a dragon. Do you recall seeing a dragon since we left home in Westland and came to the Midlands? Zed smoothed back some of the wavy tufts of his white hair. He glanced briefly to both Kara and Nikki before answering. Well, no, I can't really say that I recall having seen any dragons, but what does that have to do with... Where are they? Why haven't you seen any? Why are they gone? Zed looked at his wit's end. He spread his hands. Richard, dragons are very rare creatures. Richard leaned back in his chair, crossing one leg over his other knee. Red dragons are, but Kaelin told me that other types are relatively common, with some of the smaller ones kept for hunting and such. Zed's expression turned suspicious. What are you getting at? Richard gestured with a sweep of a hand. Where are the dragons? Why haven't we seen any? That's what I'm getting at. Zed folded his arms across his chest. I give up. What are you talking about? Well, for one thing, you don't remember. That's what I'm talking about. The Chainfire spell has affected more than just your memory of Kaelin. Don't remember what? Zed sputtered. What do you mean? Instead of answering his grandfather, Richard looked back over his shoulder. Have you seen a dragon? He asked Kara. I don't recall any. Her gaze remained fixed on him. Are you suggesting that I should? Darkon Rall kept a dragon. Since he was the Lord Rall at the time, you would have been at hand, so you would probably have seen it. Zed and Kara shared a troubled look. Richard turned his raptor gaze on Nikki. You? Nikki cleared her throat. I always thought they were mythical creatures. There aren't any in the old world. If there ever were, they haven't existed for ages. No records since the Great War have any mention of them. What about since you came to the New World? Nikki hesitated at recounting the memory. She realized, though, by the way he patiently and silently waited for her answer, that he wasn't going to let the subject go. She knew that whatever obscure equation he was working to solve wouldn't involve anything trivial. Under his silent scrutiny, Nikki felt not only a compulsion to answer, but a rising sense of foreboding. She threw the bed covers back and swung her feet down off the side of the bed. She didn't want to be lying there any longer, especially when speaking about that time. Gripping the side rail, she met Richard's gaze. When I was taking you away to the old world, before we left the new world, we came across colossal bones. I never got down off my horse to look at them, but I remember watching you walk through those rib bones. Rib bones that were well beyond twice your height. I had never seen anything like them. You said that you believed that it was the remains of a dragon. I thought that they must have been ancient bones. You said they were not, that they still had scraps of flesh on them. You pointed out all the flies buzzing around it as proof that it was what was left of a rotted carcass, not ancient remains. Richard nodded at the memory. Zed cleared his throat. And have you ever seen a dragon, Richard? One that was alive, I mean. Scarlet. What? That was her name, Scarlet. Zed blinked with incredulity. You have seen a dragon, and it has a name? Richard stood and went to the window. He rested his hands on the stone opening, leaning his weight on it as he gazed out. Yes, he said at last. Her name was Scarlet. She helped me before. She was a noble beast. He turned back from the window. But that's not the point. The point is that you knew her, too. Zed's eyebrows lifted. I knew this dragon. Not as well as Kaelin or I, but you knew her. The Chainfire event has obviously corrupted your memory of it. Chainfire was meant to make everyone forget Kaelin. But everyone is forgetting other things as well. Things that were connected with her. For all I know, you might once have known the meanings of the emblems outside the First Wizard's Enclave better than I do. If you did, that memory is lost to you. How many other things have been lost? I don't know much about the various ways to use magic, but when we were fighting the beast the other night, it seemed to me that in the past all of you used more inventive spells and powers than the simple things you tried against the threat. Except maybe what Nikki did at the end. This is what the men who came up with the chainfire spell feared most. This is why they didn't ever want it ignited. This is why they never even dared test it. They feared that once such an event was initiated, it might spread, destroying connections removed from the primary target of the spell, in this case, Kaelin. Your memory of Kaelin is lost. Your memory of Scarlet is lost. Your memory of even having seen dragons is apparently lost as well. Nikki stood. Richard, no one is arguing that the chainfire spell isn't terribly dangerous. We all know that. We all know that our memories have been damaged by the ignition of a chainfire event. Do you have any idea how disturbing it is to be intellectually aware that we all did things, new things, and new people that we now can't remember? Don't you realize how haunting it is to be in constant dread of what memories are lost and what others might be lost? That your very mind is eroding? What are you getting at, anyway? Just that. What else is being lost? I think that the destruction is expanding through everyone's memory, that their minds are eroding, as you put it. I don't think that Chainfire was a single event of merely forgetting Kaelin. I think that the spell, once activated, is an ongoing, dynamic process. I think that everyone's memory loss is continuing to spread. Zed, Kara, and Nikki all looked away from Richard's unwavering gaze. Nikki wondered how they could expect to help him, if none of them was consciously capable of using their own minds, much less keeping what they still had from day to day. How could Richard trust any of them? I'm afraid that as bad as that much of it gets more involved and far worse, Richard said, the heat having left his voice. Dragons, like many creatures in the Midlands, need and use magic to live. What if the corruption caused by the chimes extinguished the magic that they need in order to live? What if no one has seen any dragons for the last couple of years because they no longer exist, and with chainfire are now forgotten? What other creatures with magic might have also vanished from existence? Richard tapped a thumb against his own chest. We are creatures of magic. We have the gift. How long until that taint left by the chimes begins to destroy us? But perhaps... Zed's voice trailed off when he could think of no argument. The chainfire spell itself is contaminated. You all saw what it was doing to Nikki. She was in the spell, and she knows the terrible truth of it. Richard began pacing as he spoke. There is no telling how the contamination within the spell might change the way it works. It might even be that the contamination is the reason that everyone's memory loss is spreading beyond what would otherwise have happened. But worse yet, it appears that the corruption has worked in conjunction with the chainfire event in a symbiotic fashion. Zed looked up. What are you talking about? What is the mindless purpose of the chimes? Why were they created in the first place? For one single function, Richard said in answer to his own question. To destroy magic. Richard paused in his pacing to face the rest of them as he went on. The contamination left by the chimes is destroying magic. The creatures that need magic to live, dragons, for example, would likely be the first to be affected. That cascade of events will continue. But no one is aware of it because the chainfire event is simultaneously destroying everyone's memory. I think this may be happening because the chainfire spell is contaminated, causing everyone to forget the very things being lost. In much the way a leech numbs its victim so that they won't feel their blood being drained away, the chainfire spell is making everyone forget what is being lost because of the corruption of the chimes. The world is changing dramatically, and no one is even aware of it. It's as if everyone is forgetting that this is a world that is influenced by and in many ways functions through the existence of magic. That magic is dying out, and so is everyone's memory of it. Richard again leaned on the sill and stared out the window. A new day is dawning. A day in which magic continues to die out. And no one is even aware that it is fading away. When it passes entirely, I doubt that anyone will even remember it. Remember what once was. It's as if all that was this world is passing into a realm of mere legend. Zed pressed his fingers to the table as he stared into the distance. The light of the lamp accentuated the deep creases of his drawn features. His face had gone ashen. At that moment, Nicky thought that he looked very old. "Dear spirits," Zed said without looking up, "what if you're right?" They all turned to the sound of a polite knock. Kara pulled the door open. Nathan and Anne stood beyond the doorway, peering in. "We ran the standard verification web," Nathan said as he entered behind Anne, glancing around at the somber expressions. Zed looked up expectantly. "And?" "And it reveals no flaws," Anne said. "It's perfectly intact in every way." "How can that be?" Kara asked. "We all saw the trouble with the other one. It nearly killed Nicky, and would have if Lord Rawl hadn't gotten her out."
"Our point exactly," Nathan said.
Zed's gaze fell away. "An interior perspective is said to be able to reveal more than the standard verification process," he explained to Kara.
"This is not a good sign, not a good sign at all.
The contamination apparently buried itself as deeply as possible in order to conceal its presence. That's why it wasn't seen in the standard verification web."
"Or else," Anne offered as she slipped her hands into opposite sleeves of her simple gray dress.
"There is really nothing wrong with the spell. After all, none of us has ever run an interior perspective before. Such a thing hasn't been done in thousands of years. It's possible we did something wrong."
Zed shook his head. "I wish it was so, but I now believe it to be otherwise."
Nathan's brow drew down with a suspicious look, but Anne spoke before he had a chance. "Even if the sisters who unleashed the spell ran a verification web," she said, "they likely would not have run an interior perspective, so they wouldn't have suspected that it was contaminated." Richard rubbed his fingertips back and forth across his brow. "Even if they knew that it was contaminated, I don't think they cared. They wouldn't be concerned about what damage such contamination might cause the world. Their goal, after all, was to get the boxes and unleash the power of Ordon." Nathan looked from one grim face to another. "What's going on? What's happened?"
"I'm afraid that we've just learned that memory may only be the beginning of our loss."
Nicky felt rather odd standing before them in a pink nightdress as she pronounced the end of the world as they knew it.
"We are losing who we are. What we are. We are losing not just our world, but ourselves."
Richard no longer seemed to be paying attention to the conversation. He was standing stock still, staring out the window. "Someone is coming up the road to the keep."
"Maybe it's Tom and Friedrich," Nathan said.
Zed shook his head as he made for the window.
"They wouldn't be back from a patrol of the surrounding countryside this soon."
"Well, it could be that they—"
"It's not Tom and Friedrich," Richard said as he started for the door. "It's two women."
Chapter 10.
"What is it?" Rika called out as Richard, Nicky, and Kara ran toward her. Nathan and Anne had already fallen far behind. Zed was somewhere in the middle.
"Come on," Richard shouted to her as he ran past.
"Someone is coming up the keep road,"
Kara called back over her shoulder as Rika joined in the charge through the halls. Richard veered around a long stone table set against the wall beneath a huge painting of a lake. Sheltered trails could be seen burrowed through the deeply shadowed pine groves. In the distance, through a bluish haze, majestic mountains rose up to catch brushstrokes of golden sunlight. It was a scene that made Richard long to be back in his heartland woods, on the trails he knew so well. More than anything, though, the painting always reminded him of the magical summer he'd spent with Kaylin, in the home he had built for her far back in the mountains.
This is the end of disc number 3. Please continue listening on disc number 4.